If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
I North Highlands, Sacramento.
Good morning. The Supreme Court seems likely to let President Trump fire independent regulators for any reason. What did the justices say about the limits of presidential power? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, calls to increase security at San Francisco General are growing. I'm Brian Watt.
Trump says he's going to use the money collected from tariffs to pay farmers who have been hurt by tariffs. Sammy Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin. We'll hear from Louisiana farmers saying rising health care costs are another major concern. Also, what is Trump's version of the Monroe Doctrine? And most Democrats are frustrated with their party. Senator Chris Van Hollen tells me what he sees as the path forward. It's Tuesday, December 9th. On this day in 1979, smallpox was officially eradicated about a decade after global vaccination efforts. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Trump administration says it will give $12 billion to farmers in the U.S. It's to compensate them for losses incurred because of trade wars and tariffs. From member station KCUR, Frank Morris reports the one-time payment is mostly to farmers who plant crops such as corn and soybeans.
President Trump's trade wars aggravated a bleak equation for U.S. farmers. His tariffs jacked up the prices of the supplies and equipment they need to buy. And retaliatory tariffs cut export sales and drove down grain prices. Many Midwestern farmers lost money this year. Missouri farmer Richard Oswald says the bailout will help cover bills and loan payments, but won't make up for this year's losses.
They're attempting to replace profit with bailout money. It's not the same as having a good market and making a profit.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it will distribute bailout funds by March, with row crop farmers taking $11 billion and other farmers splitting another $1 billion. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
President Trump is threatening to impose another 5% tariff on Mexico if it doesn't release more waters for American farmers in the southern U.S. Mexico has argued that it's in the middle of a drought. Indiana state senators have advanced a bill to the full Senate that would redraw Indiana's congressional districts. It's an effort to send more Republicans to the House of Representatives. President Trump has demanded that Indiana Republicans do this to help him. Hundreds of people opposing redistricting crowded outside the Indiana state legislature yesterday in Indianapolis. They chanted, "Stop the steal." Indiana GOP Senate leaders have said there is not enough support to pass the redistricting measure in their chamber. However, it is expected to come up for a vote later this week. Stocks open mixed this morning as the Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting that's expected to result in lower interest rates. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 160 points in early trading.
Investors are fairly confident the central bank will lower its benchmark interest rate by a quarter percentage point tomorrow. They'll also be watching what Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues have to say about prospects for additional rate cuts in the new year. There's considerable uncertainty as the central bank's trying to keep a lid on both inflation and unemployment. Pepsi is planning to cut jobs and narrow its product lineup by 20% as it works to cut costs and lower prices. The soft drink and snack maker has been under pressure from an activist investor. And computer chip maker NVIDIA has gotten a green light from the White House to sell advanced chips in China. The U.S. government will receive a share of the proceeds. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. Negotiations between striking teachers and the West Contra Costa School District are set to resume today. KQED's Aya Ali Ahmad spoke to teachers and parents yesterday outside district headquarters.
Hundreds of educators, parents, and students rallied in Richmond to urge the district to return to the bargaining table. Erica Cheval is a parent in the district.
Our teachers want to be back with our students. Yes. And the district is the only thing getting in the way. Enough is enough.
Union leaders say the district has been stalling, but officials say they've invited teachers back to the negotiating table. Sasha Hahn is a student at El Cerrito High.
And every day that the district doesn't negotiate with our teachers is another day that us as students are being neglected.
Teachers are asking for substantial raises to address what they call a staffing crisis. I'm Aya Ali Ahmad, KQED News.
Oakland is reinstating a position that oversees public funding for the arts. In June, the city council approved a budget that made several cuts, including doing away with the cultural affairs manager role, prompting protests by artists and activists. Earlier this month, Oakland Side reports the council voted to reinstate the position. The city's cultural affairs manager helps run a volunteer board that advises Oakland on policy issues affecting artists, and they secure external funding for the arts. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Tuesday morning support comes from San Francisco Bay University, offering degree programs in tech and business for a world shaped by AI. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And by the listeners and supporters of KQED. Back to Clark Reed at 7:06 as he takes us over to Pleasanton.
An accident eastbound 580 before Foothill San Ramon. It's over the shoulder, but has things stop and go now. From Eden Canyon Road in Novato, crash southbound 101 after Highway 37. That also on the side, but things there now crawling from DeLong. And in San Francisco, the accident south 101 before Cesar Chavez is over the shoulder now, but things are slow on the westbound Skyway as you come off the upper deck of the Bay Bridge. And the Bay Bridge backed up to the maze now. Clark Reed for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Ahead on KQED News next hour, one of the medical treatments gaining traction here in the Bay Area involves ketamine. Doctors are prescribing it to treat a lot of things, including mental health. But treatment can vary, and the science is still early. What does that mean for patients? The story with Brian Watt and more next hour, 8:22, KQED News. Sacramento Valley, widespread fog again today, locally dense. Haze until late afternoon. Look for cloudy skies with the haze later today. Highs 44, that's right, high temperatures 44 to about 52. Bay Area also chilly again today with clouds, areas of fog, some sun later today on this Tuesday. Plan on highs in the 50s to the 60s again today. Warmer starting Friday.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court appears likely to hand President Trump another major victory.
Yeah, the court heard arguments Monday over whether the president should have the power to remove members of independent agencies despite laws that say he cannot. The conservative majority indicated they thought he should.
NPR's Andrea Hsu is listening to the arguments and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's back up first and just talk about this case, which involved the firing of a Federal Trade Commissioner who then sued the Trump administration to challenge her firing. But it's not about just that, right, Andrea? What's at stake here?
Yeah, well, the FTC is one of a couple dozen government agencies that share a similar structure. You know, these are regulatory agencies, typically with three or more members representing both parties who are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And Congress dictated that the president can only fire members for cause for things like neglect of duty or malfeasance. And Amit Agarwal was representing the fired FTC commissioner in court. He argued the setup has a long history dating back to the beginning of the republic.
Presidents have understood and appreciated that vital interests of the American people can be served by having constraints on the exercise of power. That is a really important part of our constitutional tradition.
Okay, but it sounds like the conservative justices didn't buy that historical argument.
That's right. They seem concerned that the separation of powers has gotten murky. You know, it seems like everyone agreed that independent agencies like the FTC and many others are not purely executive in function. Their board members and commissioners make rules and decide cases. Their actions affect people and businesses all over the country. And Solicitor General John Sauer, who was representing the Trump administration, argued that's why it's a problem that they're not accountable to the president.
That's a power vacuum. The president is answerable to the voters. They have no boss. The point is that power vacuum should not exist in our constitutional structure.
What did the liberal justices have to say about this?
Well, Layla, they took the opposite view of pretty much the same facts. Let's listen to Justice Kagan.
Isn't it problematic that what this is going to amount to is putting not only all executive power in the president, but an incredible amount of legislative slash rulemaking power and judging?
And Justice Sotomayor said that the administration is asking the court to destroy the very structure of government and take away from Congress this idea that some agencies are better off independent. Of course, Layla, you know, with the current makeup of the court, it's hard to see how that independence will stand. And in fact, Thomas Berry with the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, says he is really confident the court will overturn the 90-year-old precedent that limited the president's power of removal. And he spoke with NPR just after the arguments.
The only real question left is how are they going to write this opinion? How broad is it going to be? What reasoning are they going to use? And to what extent, if any, will they address other contested issues?
And I know one of those issues is the Federal Reserve, right?
Yeah, and the court is going to be tackling a whole different case about that next month. But yesterday, Solicitor General Sauer did quote the court's own shadow docket order that called the Fed a quasi-private, uniquely structured entity with a distinct history. You know, whether the conservative majority shifts their thinking on that after next month's arguments, that remains to be seen. But for the moment, the Fed aside, it seems the court is prepared to give the president a lot more control over agencies that traditionally were independent.
NPR's Andrea Hsu, thank you for your reporting, Andrea.
Thanks for having me.
All right, for more on this case, we turn now to Amy Howe. She's a reporter with SCOTUS Blog and was at the court for arguments on Monday. So, Amy, was there a particular exchange that sounded most telling to you about how the court might eventually rule?
One of the exchanges, or lack of exchange, was actually really telling, which is that there was almost no discussion about a question that the justices, when they agreed to take up this case, specifically instructed the litigants to tackle, which is the remedy. If the court were to uphold the removal provision and say that Trump's powers are restricted, what is the remedy for someone who is wrongfully fired? Do federal courts have the power to put that person back in office, or does that person, like Rebecca Slaughter, only get back pay? And there was basically no discussion of that, which you would expect if the court thought that there were a chance that it might ultimately uphold these removal restrictions. Justice Kavanaugh told John Sauer, the Solicitor General, that he had real concerns about this question. But then he said, but we don't need to get into that if we rule for you, meaning the Trump administration.
Were the conservatives on the court concerned about anything in particular in their questioning yesterday?
So both sides, you know, what they were really concerned about, as Andrea's discussion suggested, was the limits of the arguments that both sides were advancing. You know, and I think that, those were the strongest arguments on each side. We're pointing to the potential consequences of a ruling for the other side. Rebecca Slaughter's lawyer, you know, talked about the risks not only for the FTC, but also other independent multi-member agencies that she said Congress wanted to insulate from partisanship. But on the other hand, the justices were concerned that if Rebecca Slaughter were to prevail, Congress could take large swaths of the executive branch outside of the president's control by turning agent departments like the Department of Education or the Department of Interior into these independent multi-member agencies that would be insulated from presidential control.
So, Amy, just so I understand it, is the choice you're telling me about giving Congress a lot of power versus giving the president a lot of power?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And, you know, when it comes to the separation of powers, you know, this seems like a case in which they are more comfortable giving the president that power, but perhaps carving out some particular parts that might otherwise be affected, like the Federal Reserve.
Now, under some of the theories from the justices, does every federal worker and appointee serve at the pleasure of the president?
That is the one of the sort of central questions in this case. The Trump administration and some of the justices are sympathetic to this theory known as the unitary executive theory, which is the idea that the president has complete control under the Constitution over the executive branch. And they say that should include the power to remove members of the executive branch so that the president can carry out his duties and put his policies into place.
And I guess that's part of the argument, right, that no one that works with the federal government is completely bias-free. So the federal government should be allowed at that time to appoint anyone they feel is aligned with their beliefs.
To appoint and certainly to remove.
Yeah. Now, we heard from one analyst a few minutes ago saying that the biggest question is how broadly the court rules. What are some of the options the court has here?
So Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Alito both suggested that the court could write a relatively narrow ruling that carves out someone like an institution like the Fed. And then there are also some sticky questions relating to various federal courts like the tax court and the Court of Federal Claims, in which the judges don't have life tenure and there are similar removal restrictions. And so that could be one of the options, is to say that when you're talking about an agency like the FTC and other similar agencies that exercise what the court would call a lot of executive power, that we are going to invalidate these removal restrictions and we will deal with these other things later.
Could this mean the end of bipartisanship at agencies like the FTC?
They didn't spend a lot of time discussing that yesterday, but under the Trump administration's theory, it seems like that could be in jeopardy as well. If the court were to hold in the FTC case that Congress can't place restrictions on when the president can remove someone, that sort of the logical next step would be that it also can't tell the president who he has to put on the commission.
Now, really quick, one more thing, Amy. We also heard about how this is connected to another case about firing Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook. Did Monday's hearing give you any sense of how that case may play out?
It didn't, including because Trump has attempted to fire Lisa Cook, citing allegations of mortgage fraud from before her time on the Fed. So he's saying, in effect, that he has good cause to remove her. Cook has strongly disputed these allegations. One telling sign is that the court has allowed Lisa Cook to remain on the Fed until it hears her case and issues its decision, unlike Rebecca Slaughter.
Amy Howe reports for SCOTUS Blog. Amy, thanks.
Thank you.
Miami is holding a rare runoff election for mayor today. Democrats are watching to see if Latinos in South Florida shift toward their party. From member station WLRN in Miami, Joshua Ceballos reports.
This is the first competitive mayoral race in the city of Miami in nearly two decades. For the past 20 years, the mayor has been voted in without a runoff, and the position has been consistently held by a Latino Republican. But this year is different. Republican and former city manager Emilio Gonzalez faces off against Eileen Higgins. She is a Democrat and has served on the Miami-Dade County Commission. If Higgins wins, she'd be the city's first female elected mayor and the first non-Hispanic in decades. Observers like political analyst Susan McManus with the University of South Florida say this race could be a bellwether for the Latino vote in 2026.
Most outsiders looking in at this, their number one question is the Latino vote noticeably going to switch from Republican to Democrat? And if so, how much?
President Trump is likely to cast a shadow over the local election. He endorsed Gonzalez, who was the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services under George W. Bush. Gonzalez says he wants strict immigration standards.
I'm in support of a border policy. For history. We did not have a border policy.
He is also supporting Trump's move to end temporary protected status, which provides a legal way to stay in the U.S. for several migrant groups, including Venezuelans. Higgins, meanwhile, is critical of policies that led to the development of the ICE detention facility dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, which has been widely criticized for harsh confinement practices.
From Washington and from Tallahassee, there is this culture of trickle-down hatred. We have governments that are building cages for people rather than building housing.
Immigration issues, experts say, are dividing Latino voters in South Florida and may not only influence this mayor's race, but impact midterm elections nationwide next fall. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Ceballos in Miami.
This is NPR News.
It's your member-supported station, KQED, at 719. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. And Clark Reed is here with another look at the drive around the bay, this time as we head up north to Marin County.
In Novato, an accident, southbound 101 after 37, couple of vehicles over the side, but it's now crawling from DeLong. And in Daly City, an overturn injury accident, it's on southbound 280, the off-ramp to Serramatti, right lane of the ramp is blocked, it's jammed from Eastmore. Silver Wreck in Pleasanton, east 580 before Foothill San Ramon, stop and go there from Eden Canyon Road, and the Bay Bridge is backed up to the maze. Clark Reed for KQED.
Tuesday morning traffic support comes from Glime the Jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Marin Country Mart at Larkspur Landing, an authentic 1970s village with more than 40 independent shops, a dozen eateries, and local services such as a toy store, bookstore, and barbershop. Learn more at marincountrymart.com. Support for KQED's card donation program comes from local Kia dealers announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at Kia.com. Coming up next, NPR's Leila Fadel asks Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland about the future of his party.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, in California, mobile homes make up between 4 and 6% of the housing stock, and they play a critical role in creating affordable housing. New state laws and efforts by for-profit developers to buy up mobile home communities are putting this kind of housing at risk. We're going to talk to experts about the challenges that mobile homeowners face. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
And looking ahead to Forum at 10 with Mina Kim, we're going to hear about an investigation into the oversight of California's child farm workers who can legally work on farms as young as age 12. Journalist Robert J. Lopez spoke with many children who work in the state's fields. Join us for Forum. It's 9 to 11 today. Rebroadcast tonight, 8 to 10. Support for NPR this morning comes from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. Heifer International, where people can find gifts designed to make a difference. A goat, chicken, or cow can change the future for a family in need. Learn more at heifer.org/NPR. And Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And by the sustaining members of KQED. Tuesday morning time, now 7:22.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We've been exploring the future of the Democratic Party as it finds itself in opposition to this president. Our next conversation as part of our series is with Chris Van Hollen. He spent decades in state and federal politics. He's currently a Democratic senator for Maryland, and he says his party needs to do more to push back against President Trump's policies.
I'd say we have an incomplete grade. It's a work in progress. Early in the Trump administration, too few recognized the clear and present danger that the Trump administration posed to our democracy.
I asked Van Hollen about a recent Pew poll. It shows that over two-thirds of Democrats are frustrated with their party, and that's quite a spike.
Those numbers, when you see them, what do you think your party is doing wrong?
Well, I think we need to do two things. Number one, I think we need to fight back at every juncture and fight back effectively and speak to all the issues that the American people are concerned about. But you're absolutely right. Even though Donald Trump's, you know, approval has gone down, people still don't have confidence in the Democrats as an alternative. And that means we also need to be much more clear about what we're fighting for, not just what we're against. And I do believe it's important that we focus on an agenda that says we'll take on powerful special interests in order to advance the public interests at every single juncture. I think Democrats have become too much perceived as the party of the status quo when people want to see us move in a different direction.
What can your party do now, though? I mean, you basically have no power, and we don't know what will happen in the midterms. What should your party be doing right now when it comes to policies they don't agree with and they don't think help the American people?
Well, we need to resist the Trump lawbreaking at every juncture. I mean,
but like in practical terms, how does that look?
Well, I mean, for example, Democracy Forward is a group. I just met with them again We work on, you know, litigation strategies. I mean, one of the things that has slowed down, you know, the law-breaking administration has been these, you know, cases in court. But you're right. At the end of the day, we need to win back majorities in the House and the Senate.
You have had a lot of leadership roles within the party. You were in charge of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in two different election cycles. When you look at both the successful elections and the unsuccessful elections for your party, and you think about messaging, what do you want to see from your party that is different in the run-up to the midterms?
Well, what I'd like to see is an agenda that, again, makes clear what we're fighting against. And, you know, we do have a president who is breaking the law every day in one way or another. My view is that in addition to beating that, we need to put forward alternatives. So, for example, I will be proposing a tax cut for working class people, middle class people who are just making enough income to get by based on the, you know, standard of living. I don't think anybody should be taxed with a federal income tax where it takes their overall income below the standard of living. Those are the kind of things that I think that we need to embrace going forward in this election.
I mean, it's no question that you are a huge critic of this president and his administration's policies, but you've also been open about criticizing your own party. And I think there's no place that it's more evident of fracturing than what we saw during the campaign for New York mayor with Zohran Mamdani, and so many in leadership either didn't endorse him or took a really long time to come on side. What do you think that race and your party's reaction to it from the newcomers versus the status quo says about your party?
Look, I'm a big tent Democrat, meaning we should elect, you know, people in every state. I mean, Joe Manchin was somebody who could win in West Virginia. I didn't always agree with Joe Manchin. And Mamdani clearly, you know, energized a huge part of the electorate. And so, yes, I was disappointed that he did not get the full support of Democrats across the board. I hope going forward, the Democratic Party will embrace these new voices who clearly connected with voters and energized the voters.
And you were much more stringent than that. I mean, you called people who didn't endorse him spineless.
Well, I do believe that if you want to elect Democrats and shake up the status quo, you can't take an a la carte approach, right? My view is if we're going to be a big tent party, we need to embrace younger voices.
Who is your party's leader right now?
Right now, you've got people across the country. These grassroots organizations are those that are providing sort of the fuel to take on and resist this lawless president. The No King's Day was a great example. So I say to people across the country, there's no posse coming, right? I mean, there's no like big, you know, reinforcements out of Washington, D.C. This is a moment where each of us has to use our power in our own ways to fight back. This is a period of sort of building and rebuilding. And I think that that's healthy. I don't think that's a problem.
So really, there isn't a clear leader. I mean, would that become maybe clearer after the midterms? Would you run for president in 2028?
That is not my goal, right? I'm very focused first on the 2026 midterms, but I do really plan to play a big part in the conversation about where our party and country goes. You know, I was invited by the Democratic Party in, you know, Polk County, Iowa, to deliver the keynote at their steak fry. And I really talked about what you and I are talking about, right? The need to more effectively take on a lawless president, but also outline the measures we will take to shake up the status quo and allow the Democratic Party to regain the trust and confidence of the American people.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you.
This is NPR News.
KQED News in a minute after Clark Reed with Bay Area Traffic.
In Daly City, an overturned injury accident. Southbound 280, the off-ramp to Serramonte, the right lane of the ramp is blocked. It's jammed from Eastmore. Novato, an accident. Southbound 101 after Highway 37, that's got things a crawl from DeLong. And in San Jose, an accident northbound 101 before Oakland Road. It's slow there from Yerba Buena. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Silicon Valley Community Foundation launching the Community Lifeline Fund, a response to public policy shifts endangering low-income residents' access to essential services. Info about supporting the fund at svcf.org. I'm Dave Freeman on KQED, Tuesday morning, the time 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The man accused of fatally stabbing a social worker at San Francisco General Hospital last week is set to be arraigned on a murder charge this afternoon. Prosecutors say that Wilfredo Jose Tortolero Arici had gone to the hospital's HIV clinic to speak to a doctor, but was asked to leave by a social worker. Arici and the victim, Alberto Rangel, walked to the elevator together when he allegedly grabbed the victim from behind and stabbed him multiple times. The sheriff's office has said a deputy was called shortly before the attack to provide security after a patient, thought to be Arici, threatened a doctor. Hospital officials say they're retaining an outside security firm to conduct an assessment after last week's attack, following calls from hospital workers and elected officials for safety improvements. KQED's Marisa Lagos has that part of our story.
Supervisor Shimon Walton's district includes the hospital. Walton says he's asking the city's sheriff's office and public health departments for detailed information on current safety protocols for the hospital and what will be changed as a result of this incident.
We have to come up with policies and the protocols that are going to protect employees. I think right now, you know, just off the top of my head, things like making sure there are metal detectors and areas of the hospital so folks can't get weapons inside.
Walton says there have long been safety concerns among hospital staff. I'm Marisa Lagos, KQED News.
State workplace safety regulators say they are investigating the incident. Cal OSHA records show that the public hospital has been fined about $20,000 for at least four violations linked to accidents or complaints since 2017. In one incident, a patient in the acute psychiatric ward punched a nurse on the side of her head and kicked her. She required hospitalization. The state has up to 6 months to issue citations if it finds safety violations. In other news, California fire safety regulations that were supposed to be implemented by the start of 2026 will be pushed back again. The California Board of Forestry announced the move yesterday. KQED's Danielle Venton explains.
The regulation to create an area 5 feet around a home where nothing can easily catch fire was supposed to be completed by the State Board of Forestry by the start of 2023. That never happened. Then, following the LA fires, Governor Newsom directed they be completed by the end of this year. But the Board of Forestry is delaying the matter until March, citing a lack of public buy-in, concerns over the cost of implementation, and the problem of combating misinformation. Some community groups have told homeowners they'll be required to pull out trees. While trees will need to be limbed, removal of mature trees is not part of the proposal. I'm Danielle Venton, KQED News.
In sports, the Sharks visit the Flyers in Philadelphia, 4 o'clock our time. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from Oakland, San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyAwayK.com. President Trump has proposed a $12 billion plan to help farmers across the country, but some say they also need help with the rising health insurance costs they may face if certain subsidies expire. One of the stories coming up. California stories also coming up this morning.
If you're planning a trip to a national park next year, get ready for some big changes. The Trump administration is dropping free entry on civil rights holidays like MLK Day and Juneteenth and adding President Trump's birthday instead. Plus, international visitors will face higher fees and new ID checks. I'm Madi Bolaños. We'll walk you through what's changing and why it matters on the next California Report.
Find out more next hour at 8:51. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. On Tuesday, I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning to you. Morning Edition continues as the time approaches 7:35.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump has a plan to give $12 billion to farmers across the country. And Trump said Monday that the one-time payments will come from tariff revenue.
This relief will provide much-needed certainty to farmers as they get this year's harvest to market and look ahead to next year's crops.
Those tariffs that Trump says are paying for the farm relief are also one of the reasons some farmers are struggling. Another is rising health care costs. Drew Hawkins with the Gulf States Newsroom spoke with some farmers in Louisiana about their concerns.
James Davis is a third-generation row crop farmer in northeast Louisiana. He grows cotton, corn, and soybeans on around 2,500 acres.
Just been farming pretty much all my life.
Farmers have been hit really hard this year, Davis says, even with what he says is the best crop he's ever had. He says the Trump administration's tariffs mean they can't export their commodities because other countries have also placed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. When farmers can't sell their crop and make back enough money, it makes it harder to get crop loans the following year. Davis says the money President Trump is pledging can't come soon enough.
I was in with my banker projecting 2026. And without bailouts, it is hard to make crop loans work on paper. So it's imperative and very imperative that the Trump administration get these payments out as soon as possible.
It's not just crop loans that are harder to get. Davis says because farmers have been struggling to make ends meet this year, it's also harder to pay for health insurance. He and his wife are able to pay for their health insurance because of enhanced premium tax credits through the Affordable Care Act. Those subsidies are set to expire at the end of the month. If that happens, he says the cost for their insurance will quadruple.
That number was like $2,700 per month.
Davis describes himself as a moderate Democrat. A poll released this month from the health policy research group KFF shows 72% of Republicans enrolled in marketplace plans support extending the subsidies. That's reflective of people like Daniel Rhodes, a Republican who uses the subsidies to help him and his wife pay for their health insurance.
There's a lot of people who won't be able to eat that big of a change overnight. I mean, that's, I don't know how people can.
Rhodes lives in West Monroe, Louisiana, a small town surrounded by farmland in House Speaker Mike Johnson's district. Rhodes, a landscaper, says he supports Speaker Johnson's leadership, except when it comes to health care and the ACA subsidies.
This was a big one that I really just took the opposite side of the fence and said, like, look, this is a crazy hill to die on to say we're going to lock up the budget over health care subsidies. Like, man, pick any other thing.
Rhodes isn't the only Republican in Johnson's district who supports extending the subsidies. Susie Halley runs a food pantry in Farmerville in Union Parish. She says local farmers are already struggling to pay health care premiums, and Congress needs to stop playing party politics.
Mr. Johnson, or whoever else, it may be Republican or Democrat, I don't care. Let's fix the problem.
This week, the Senate is expected to vote on a Democratic proposal to extend the enhanced premium tax credits for 3 years, but the plan is not expected to get the votes it needs to advance. Over in the House, Speaker Johnson said recently that he plans to present his caucus with a plan to bring down health insurance costs, and adds it's, quote, only our party that is going to bring down premiums. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
The Trump administration has a new name for its aggressive policies in the Western Hemisphere, including military attacks on alleged drug smugglers and threats of regime change in Venezuela. His administration is reaching back 2 centuries and calling this Trump's version of the Monroe Doctrine. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie is following all this and is with me in the studio now. Good morning.
Hi, Layla.
Okay, so for those of us who've forgotten U.S. history here, just give us a refresher on the Monroe Doctrine.
So U.S. President James Monroe proclaimed this doctrine in 1823, saying European countries should not interfere in the Western Hemisphere, that this is a U.S. zone of influence. Now, any number of U.S. presidents have cited the Monroe Doctrine. For example, Teddy Roosevelt, who oversaw the building of the Panama Canal in the early 1900s. As we know, the U.S. carried out many military and political interventions in the 20th century, though in recent decades, the U.S. approach has been a little less heavy-handed.
And to say the least, not all of these interventions have been successful. What is Trump's version of this doctrine?
Well, we've been seeing it really since the beginning of this term. He's threatened or imposed actual tariffs against major trading partners from Mexico to Brazil. The U.S. is waging this ongoing military strikes against suspected drug traffickers in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and there's this major U.S. naval and troop presence. It's really the largest in decades, and it's accompanied by threats to oust Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. Here's Christopher Hernandez Roy with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank.
The use of hard power, the use of economic power to achieve objectives is something that is more consistent with a sort of a Monroe Doctrine type of approach to the region, and I think that's what we're seeing.
And the Trump administration made this explicit last week when it released the National Security Strategy. Now, this document marks a major change in the overall U.S. approach to the world and to Latin America in particular. It says prominently, quote, "We will assert and enforce a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine."
How is the overall strategy being received in the region? I mean, there are the questions of the legality around these attacks, but particularly the idea that the U.S. military might attack Venezuela directly.
Yeah, a Brazil research group, Atlas Intel, recently conducted a very detailed survey across the region and found that 53% of Latin Americans would support a U.S. military intervention. Now, in contrast, polls in the U.S. have found a much lower level of support among U.S. citizens, where there's only around 30% who say they'd support a U.S. military action. Now, these findings surprised Hernandez Roy.
It kind of flips what you would expect on its head, where you'd think that there would be more support in the U.S. for removing a dictator than support among Latin Americans, given the long history of U.S. interventionism.
So when it comes to Trump's approach to the region, he's also, Hernandez-Roy's also made the point that a number of countries like Mexico have opted for compromise rather than confrontation.
Right.
No one really wants to be the country having a showdown with the Trump administration.
You mentioned that the original Monroe Doctrine was designed to stop other countries from influencing geopolitics in the hemisphere. So what's the goal here? Will Trump be able to stop or reverse the influence of powers like China in Latin America?
Well, Layla, that's a tall order, and here's a pretty remarkable statistic. China is now the leading trade partner of every country in South America except Colombia, where it's second to the U.S.
Wow.
China has made tremendous economic inroads with Latin America. Trump wants to boost the U.S. role, but some of his policies can be counterproductive. When he placed huge tariffs on China, China responded by halting the purchase of U.S. soybeans and began buying them in Argentina. So getting tough with Latin American countries could have unintended consequences.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Sure thing, Layla.
This is NPR News.
KQED Traffic's Clark Reed takes a glance at the San Mateo Bridge.
An accident westbound 92 at Industrial is over the side now, but has things backed up to the Nimitz. In Daly City, an overturned injury accident southbound 280, the off-ramp to Serramati. The right lane of that ramp remains blocked. It's a jam from Eastmore. In Novato, an accident. South 101 after 37, it's over the side, but a crawl from DeLong, and it continues slow down to the Marin Civic Center now. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support today comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from El Camino Health. Open enrollment happens once a year. More about which health plans provide access to El Camino Health doctors and nationally recognized hospitals at elcaminohealth.org/openenrollment. VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
Clinics are popping up all over offering ketamine in a variety of settings for depression, for anxiety, for chronic pain. There isn't a real standardized approach to how to treat someone using ketamine. Experts kind of describe this moment as the Wild West. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm a health correspondent for KQED. You can find my story about ketamine at kqed.org.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Nuclear power plants that had been retired are coming back into service to meet rising electricity demand for AI.
What we're doing here is exciting. Having a reliable power source that keeps your electricity costs as low, everybody should be rooting for that.
When power plants come back from the dead, next time on Here and Now.
Catch Here and Now at 11.
In Uganda, a program seeks to address poverty by giving cash and financial coaching to people who need it. Now, funding to global development programs like this are being cut.
If we can find a better way of squeezing more juice out of whatever we're doing, then you can expand and help more people. And instead of going to 1,000 communities, we can go to 2,000 communities.
More on those challenges on All Things Considered from NPR News.
More about it, the latest news and more, early edition of One this afternoon on KQED News and NPR's All Things Considered with an update later at 6:30 p.m. Support for NPR comes from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson, in theaters this Friday. And by the listeners of KQED, morning clouds, areas of dense fog, some sun later today around the bay, highs 50s to the 60s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Indiana University sports fans are experiencing a once-in-a-lifetime season, and it's not for the sport you might think. University of Men's basketball program has won 5 national titles, but this year it's being overshadowed by the football team, which is undefeated and won their first outright Big Ten title since 1945. And this success seems like it's happened overnight. Here to talk about the program's rise, we've called up Michael Nizalik. He covers Indiana University sports for the Bloomington Herald Times. So, Michael, is the Hoosier State's flagship campus now a football school?
It's getting there. If Kurt Cignetti has his way, it will be in maybe in a couple of weeks, right? he's trying his hardest, and you know he's made promises and cashed all the checks he's kind of laid out there. And this Big Ten title was certainly a huge one.
And Cignetti, that's the coach, and he's really the one responsible for this big change. How was he able to do this?
Yeah, well, he's also kind of the GM, right? Or like the talent evaluator in this age of college football with the transfer portal. He's brought in all the right guys. And he does that too with the coaching staff. He's got a lot of guys that have been with him, going back years, including defensive coordinator Brian Haynes and offensive coordinator Mike Shanahan. Those are the guys he trusts. It all works together. There's a lot of synergy. And then obviously the quarterback, he's a quarterback guy going back. He's a quarterback's coach. He has that eye for talent. Brought in Curtis Rourke last year, who had success, and now Fernando Mendoza, and it all's kind of gone together.
Yeah, Fernando Mendoza is probably one of the leading candidates for the Heisman Trophy. He had a couple of seasons at Cal, at Berkeley, but what's making him so good this year?
Well, it's development, right? And last year at Cal, he didn't have an offensive line. He was sacked, I think, 40 times, which was tied for the most in the country. He was on the run. You know, Indiana's put talent around him. And then with Cignetti, Shanahan, they've all kind of brought them into their system, got him comfortable, got him reading the defense. And he's got NFL arm talent. They've just put the system around him to unlock that.
Tell us what the atmosphere on game days is like in Bloomington. I mean, how has it changed? It had to be completely different even a few years ago.
Well, absolutely. The stat I like to use is since like 1970 when they expanded Memorial Stadium, they've only had 18 sellouts. 8 of them have been in the last 2 years during Cignetti's tenure. It's completely transformed. He's bought in. You know, he's got the students to buy in, and he didn't like what was happening here. 5 weeks into the season last year, he told fans they got to show up, they got to be loud, and they got to start staying for the entire game. and they listened. They took it seriously, and he's made an atmosphere, made Memorial Stadium a hard place to play. He hasn't lost there yet. They have the longest active home winning streak in the country.
Staying for the entire game. I'm from L.A., Michael. L.A. sports fans don't do that. We got to go to
dinner. They would if he was the coach.
There you
yell at him.
There you go. All right, so they're the number one seed, which means they have a bye in the first round. So they're waiting the winner of Alabama and Oklahoma. Do you think they have what it takes to at least get past one of those two schools when they play in the college football playoff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they'll, be favored in any game up leading up to the title. I think there could be a rematch in the title game against Ohio State. I think they're in a really good spot. I think people saw in that Big Ten title game, Ohio State was being talked about having the best defense in the country, having this offensive talent. Indiana matched them everywhere on the field. I don't see them being an underdog. I think they're going to be a heavy favorite in that at quarterfinals game, whoever their opponent is.
My colleague Steve Inskeep is from Indiana. He didn't go to Indiana University, but I'm sure he's rooting for them in the college football playoffs. Michael Nizalik covers Indiana University sports for the Bloomington Herald Times. Michael, thanks.
Absolutely.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
It's coming up on 7:50. Let's head over to KQED traffic with Clark heading back up to Marin County.
Had an accident in Novato. It's southbound 101 after Highway 37. It's out of the lanes now, but it's crawling from DeLong and continues heavy down to the Marin Civic Center now. In Hayward, an accident, south 880 before A Street. It's over the side and things there stop and go from 238. And on the San Mateo Bridge, a crash, westbound 92 at Industrial. That's over the shoulder, but stop and go from 880. Bay Bridge still backed up to the maze. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Glime, the jeweler. Marketplace Morning Report ahead for you this morning. Walmart announcing plans to change its stock listing to the NASDAQ from the New York Stock Exchange. Hear why America's biggest retailer is making the switch. Also, President Trump says he will create a single national rule for artificial intelligence. Get a closer look at what it could mean to establish limits on states' AI rules. All ahead at 7:51.
I'm Amna Nawaz. On the next News Hour, one-on-one with former Trump ally, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's Tuesday on the PBS News Hour.
Ahead at 3 this afternoon.
On the next Fresh Air, Rae Seehorn, the star of the new series Pluribus. You may know her as the co-star of Better Call Saul, which was both the sequel and prequel to Breaking Bad. Vince Gilligan created both shows. Pluribus has a sci-fi premise, but asks larger questions about happiness, anger, conformity, and resistance. Join us.
Tonight's Fresh Air, listener-supported too, 7 p.m. on KQED. And remember, turn up the volume on the voices that bring you closer to the Bay Area. Your particular gift powers local news, culture, and community connection. Give today at kqed.org/donate. Thank you for your gift. Good morning. The time now, 7:51.
Does joining NASDAQ make you cool?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Walmart is moving from the New York Stock Exchange to the NASDAQ market. It's the biggest company to ever make the switch from platforming its stock down on New York's Wall Street to a company with a showroom on New York's Times Square. Thing is, NASDAQ has a cool kids growth through tech vibe, and it's where stocks of the likes of Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Nvidia live. To understand this better, let's bring in Jay Ritter, a professor of finance at the University of Florida. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's be fair to Walmart here, right? You think of them as a big box retailer, but they have a sizable online presence that is a stiff competitor for tech company Amazon.
Absolutely. Indeed, because of the growth in their online business and successful competition against Amazon, Walmart is now selling at a higher price earnings ratio than most of the so-called Magnificent Seven.
You know, it's a popular way to invest these days is to buy the whole S&P 500 index. And so if you're in that index, companies stand to benefit just by virtue of that inclusion. Is there a kind of bump that Walmart might get for being included on the NASDAQ market, which is not an index in itself?
By moving to NASDAQ, Walmart is able to be not only in the S&P 500 index, but also in NASDAQ's QQQ index for the 100 largest companies on NASDAQ. And while not as much money is indexed there as with the S&P 500, some is, and an estimate is another $20 billion is going to be invested in Walmart as a result.
Now, if you go visit NASDAQ, it's computer-driven. You go over to the New York Stock Exchange, it's secretly computer-driven, but there are still some humans wandering around. That's where you still get the still photographs at the end of a bad market day is over at the New York Stock Exchange. Do you think the New York Stock Exchange needs to do some rethinking about its brand?
Not necessarily. There are many markets where the individual stocks get traded. So just because a stock changes from the New York Stock Exchange to NASDAQ where it's listed, that doesn't actually mean that much of the trading volume is going to be changing. It is still the case that the New York Stock Exchange does provide certain certification. And in recent months, NASDAQ has been under a little bit of scrutiny because of a lot of penny stock IPOs that have been listing there, many of which have been manipulated and most of which have crashed and burned.
Jay Ritter at the University of Florida, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, as always.
And let's do the numbers. The Dow is now up 107 points, 0.2%. The S&P is up 0.1%. The NASDAQ is up just slightly, 13 points. The government just reported that the number of job openings held steady in October. Hires, quits, layoffs, quite stable, 7 million job openings if your resume fits. This pushed up the 10-year interest rate to 4.17%. With the guardians of interest rates at the Fed, they've started their meeting with a decision due tomorrow. Jeffrey Cleveland is chief economist at Payden and Riegel in Los Angeles. Jeffrey, good morning.
Hey, good morning, David.
All right, so tomorrow, our central bankers are going to lower their key interest rate by 0.25%, right?
Well, you say that like it's a slam dunk, but, you know, a couple weeks ago, you would have been skating on thin ice with that opinion. I think it was more of a coin flip at that point whether the Fed would cut rates in December. Now the market has come around to your view and is expecting a rate cut.
What? Because of signs the job market is weakening. That's one place.
I think for me, the key is the weakness in the labor market. That does, I think, warrant an additional rate cut. So that is probably the main event. The reason I bring up the uncertainty is I think investors are now looking out into 2026. And of course, the question will become what happens next. So I think the Fed will keep cutting rates, but I think, you know, any member of the FOMC will say, you know, it depends on the data. So we'll have to see what happens with the unemployment rate and importantly with inflation in the year ahead.
Yeah. How many rate cuts? How big? Exactly when? All? It's the perpetual central banking mystery. Jeffrey Cleveland, chief economist, Payden and Riegel. Thank you so much.
Have a good week.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Bitwarden Password Manager. Bitwarden is built to secure online shopping accounts during the holiday season or any time. Learn more at bitwarden.com.
Consumers are feeling worse about their current and future financial situations. That's among key findings from the latest survey of consumer expectations out of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Marketplace's Carla Javier has that.
Consumers have greater awareness of what's going on in the economy than they get credit for, says NerdWallet's Elizabeth Renter.
Most of us shop for groceries, most of us buy gasoline, and in that way, we can be in tune with what inflation is doing, even if we're not watching the numbers that come from the BLS.
And with government reports delayed or canceled due to the shutdown, consumer expectations are especially useful, says Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan.
So in the absence of that hard data, looking instead to how people are feeling becomes all the more important.
And how people feel can actually impact the economy.
If I'm worried about losing my job next year, I might pull back a little bit, tighten the purse strings.
That could affect businesses, which could affect hiring. You get the idea.
When Vicki Bogan at Duke looked at the latest survey from the New York Fed, she noticed somewhat mixed findings.
You could say employment expectations improved slightly.
But the survey did show that people think medical costs will increase.
Medical costs are one of the leading causes of bankruptcy for households in general.
Another key takeaway, consumers told the New York Fed that they expect the inflation rate to remain steady over the next year. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
Our producers are Tamar Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And from San Francisco, more Morning Edition, KQED News, and the California Report ahead, just under a minute away. 7:59 the time. Here's traffic with Clark Reed starting in Oakland.
A stall westbound 580 before 80 in the maze. Number 2 lane is blocked. It's jammed up from 980 and 24 now. In Novato, southbound 101 after 37, a wreck there has things still delayed. Stop and go really from DeLong. Continues heavy down to the Marin Civic Center. And in Hayward, there's a crash south 880 before A Street. That's over the side. Things there stop and go from 238. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy Mechanic Construction, Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Netflix presenting Cover Up, from Citizen 4 director Laura Poitras with access to notes from reporter Seymour Hirsch. This documentary captures the